meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Let's get right at this. If you've been watching the news, you'll heard of the brutal murder on a Greyhound bus traveling in Manitoba near Brandon, Manitoba in particular, not too far from where I broadcast and not too far from where my next guest is working. Of course, you know Mike McIntyre is a Winnipeg Free Press crime reporter and the host of the syndicated radio show, Mike on or Crime and Punishment. I'm sorry. It should be the Mike on Crime on Punishment show. I don't know, something like that. But he's always a welcome guest here. And in fact, he is following up this case. He's in Edmonton and is checking into the background of Wyong Lee. I hope I'm saying that properly. The person who is allegedly responsible for the death of Tim McLean and the STC bus, or the Greyhound bus, I'm sorry. Mike, welcome.
Hey, good to be here.
Now, you're in Edmonton. This is, you've been doing this type of work, this crime reporting, for a long time. You've covered everything from soup to nuts. Did you ever think that you'd cover a story like this?
No, I've covered a lot of brutal murder cases, and you know, and I hate to sort of rank one above another and say this one's worse. Anytime somebody dies, of course, it's horribly tragic. What makes this one stand out, though, of course, is the way that the accused or the killer killed his victim. And not just the brutal nature by which he killed his victim, but the fact it was done in front of so many people. This was, in a sense, a public killing, witnessed not only by 36 bus passengers, literally from all walks of life. You had, I think the youngest was a six-year-old child on the bus. There was a couple in their 80s. You had a pair of tourists from France.
Yep.
I mean, this was an international audience that witnessed this of all ages. But not only that, you had the RCMP witnessing the killing and the aftermath of the killing all before their horrified eyes. And that is what really puts this into the realm of the extreme, the kind of case that we don't see, not just in Canada, but I'd suggest in really any country, any civilized country.
The victim, Tim McLean, a young guy sitting there on the bus traveling to Winnipeg, listening to his headphones, his MP3 player or whatever, and again allegedly stabbed to death and then decapitated by Vince Wyong Lee, and even some cannibalism reported. The most seasoned police officer would never see anything like that in his experience or her experience, but yet this seemed to happen. You're in Edmonton right now. What are you doing there?
Well, this is where Vincent Lee had lived the last couple of years, and in fact, this is where his journey on that ill-fated bus trip began a week ago, or 8 days ago, I guess, is when Vincent Lee left Edmonton on the Greyhound. He ended up, I shouldn't say he left that day, Tim McLean left that day. Vincent Lee, it appears, had left maybe a day or two earlier because Lee joined up with the bus in Brandon, Manitoba. McLean had been out in Edmonton working. He is from Winnipeg. He's a carny. He travels across the country working at various summer carnivals and festivals. So McLean had been here for work. Lee was here because he was living and working here by himself. He had left his wife of many years back in Winnipeg after their relationship took a hit, largely due to his erratic behavior. And so we're trying to retrace the steps a little bit to find out as much as we can about who Vincent Lee is and was, whether there was anything going on in Edmonton that perhaps could have predicted what was to come.
If you're just tuning in, Winnipeg Free Press crime reporter and syndicated radio host of the Crime and Punishment radio show, Mike McIntyre, is with me. And now this story not only is, as horrific as you can imagine, think of your worst horror movie that you've ever seen and then times it by 10, and this is what happened on this Greyhound bus. But there's also a story of some heroics, the bus driver, a passenger, a trucker that comes by, and the alleged killer trying to escape, even trying to drive away on the bus. Talk about that.
Well, it certainly has been an interesting point of debate, which I'll get to in just a moment. Let's start with the bus driver. I don't think there's any debate. His actions, very heroic. Police applauding him for how he handled the situation. As soon as he was told that there was this attack going on in the back of the bus, he quickly pulled the bus over to the side of the Trans-Canada Highway and allowed all of the passengers, save for poor Tim McLean, of course, to escape and run off the bus. What he did next, though, may have saved other lives and perhaps some highway carnage. He was able to then quickly lock the bus, locking the accused, Vincent Lee, inside, now alone with just the victim. And he was able to disable the bus to the point that it couldn't be driven anymore. It appears that Vincent Lee, at one point, actually tried to drive off with the bus,
yeah,
which one can only imagine what could have been, or what the result of that could have been, had he made off down the highway now with this bus. And so certainly the driver's actions, no question. Where I say that there's been an interesting debate is it gets into the actions of the passengers, and I would suggest the police, and here's why. 36 passengers on that bus, many have questioned why they all went running off the bus and didn't try and do something immediately to stop the attack. Now, Tim McLean may have been dead within the first stab or two. We don't know that, and he may have been beyond saving. But a lot of people, especially in the United States, this story, of course, has made headlines around the world,
yep,
but on a lot of message boards, people in the States have been taking some shots, saying, you know, there's the wimpy Canadians. How could they just leave a guy to be killed and brutalized the way they did? And so certainly some have called the actions of the passengers into question. There were a couple passengers, as you mentioned, Dana, who did try and go back and confront the suspect. At that point, it was obvious that the victim was deceased. In fact, he had been beheaded at that point. Lee then allegedly came at them with a knife, and they quickly got back off the bus. Where I suggest the police might be open to some criticism is the fact they waited 2 hours surrounding this bus with just the killer and the obviously deceased man inside.
Yep.
They didn't storm the bus. They waited for him to come to them, and eventually Lee smashed out a window and jumped through it. But they didn't storm the bus, and during those 2 hours, that is when he continued to defile the body, consume pieces of it, according to the allegations, and continue to dismember parts of the body. And if I'm McLean's family, I might be asking why the police didn't do something. Clearly, Tim McLean, his life couldn't have been saved, but maybe some of his dignity could have been saved.
You know, and when it comes to that, I think you made a good point. The RCMP initially weren't saying too much. In fact, they weren't even acknowledging the fact that the deceased had been decapitated. And then, lo and behold, there was a leak of some radio transmissions of the RCMP to their dispatchers and back and forth to each other on the internet. And that's a shame that that had to happen. But they had to save face and come out and do another press conference. You know, questioning that, one has to wonder, Mike, and you do this for a living as far as writing stories, does the public really need to hear the radio transmissions back and forth, or was that a mistake? Of course, there's nothing you can do when it gets leaked.
Right. No, I don't think they need to hear that. I can tell you, at my employer, we had transcripts, we had audio of those conversations, and we didn't post them. Not everyone sort of played by those rules, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I think at that point, there wasn't necessarily a newsworthy angle. If you could justify it and say that it was in the public interest somehow, perhaps there would be a reason to do it. And for instance, we've published some of the gory details that we've already discussed tonight. We've published those in the paper. Some people have taken offense to that. We've tried to explain it as this. the accused here, there's a very good chance he's going to be found not criminally responsible, perhaps even unfit to stand trial.
Yeah.
In order for the public to fully understand why that may happen and why he may avoid criminal responsibility, I think it's important that people understand the full effect of what he is accused of doing. And you can only do that, of course, by including some of the more gruesome details. But certainly the transmissions of the tapes, I mean, maybe if it's done in the context of a story about, you know, how overwhelmed the police were and the trauma of being a police officer, then maybe in that context it works. But just to throw it out there, to say, look at how gory this is, I don't believe that's right.
Mike, you mentioned, of course, there's other passengers on this Greyhound bus. What has Greyhound done as far as any sort of compensation or any sort of assistance to those passengers that were traveling during this carnage?
Well, they quickly got them all to a nearby community of Brandon, Manitoba, and they did say they were offering trauma counseling to all the passengers. That's as far as I'm aware of what happened. I don't know how many passengers have taken up the offer. I suspect lots of them may, given what they were exposed to.
Yeah.
It's interesting, Dana, just the other day, Greyhound was set to launch. In fact, they already had launched, and then they quickly backtracked and canceled it. What may be the worst timed ad campaign in history. They had just launched a new ad campaign trying to encourage more people to take the bus. And, of course, playing off some of the air rage incidents that we hear about where people lose it on airplanes and frustrations over flight delays and the high cost. The ad campaign basically was promoting, when's the last time you heard of bus rage? And that was a Greyhound ad. There were billboards up in many Canadian cities. And as I say, the timing could not have been worse for something like that, and Greyhound quickly realizing the error of its ways, backtracked, pulled all the ads, and says it won't happen again.
Vincent Lee has made an initial court appearance. I believe it was adjourned to try and get him some counsel. What do you know?
Yeah, I just witnessed it yesterday in person out in Portage la Prairie, Manitoba. It was actually his second court appearance. His behavior was bizarre to the extreme. He refused to speak any words save for one utterance of the phrase, "Please kill me." Other than that, his communication was nonverbal. He was grunting, making sort of groaning noises, and then shaking his head vigorously up and down, side to side, for yes and no answers. He refused to speak with a lawyer. He says through his shaking of his head that he does not want a lawyer. He refused, or said he is not willing to agree to a psychiatric assessment. The judge, after hearing all the facts, said, "Too bad, you're going to get one." His case has now been adjourned for a month. And in that time, a psychologist is going to meet with Lee. Good luck to him.
Yeah.
That psychologist now has the task of trying to put together a report from a man who clearly won't even speak that will determine where this case goes from here. Is he fit to stand trial? That's the initial question that must be answered. If he's found to be not fit to stand trial, that ends the matter. He'd go to a mental health facility, possibly for the rest of his life. The case could resume against him should at any point down the road doctors deem him now fit to stand trial. If he's found fit to stand trial right off the hop, the next question is he criminally responsible? And if he's found to be not criminally responsible, once again, he would not go to a prison. He'd go to a mental health facility, and that would be for an indeterminate period of time that could last as long as forever.
The young victim, Tim McLean, again, our condolences go to his family and friends, and I know there has been a lot of internet activity and tribute pages, etc. Have you had any contact with your investigation with his family?
I have spoken to some extended friends. His uncle did do a news conference last weekend, but I've had some conversation with his former girlfriend and a close friend who obviously everybody's shaken up. You can imagine the trauma of finding out how your loved one died.
Yeah.
And then add to that the whole world knowing it. Tim McLean's death is made headlines around the world. You mentioned some of the tribute pages. It's really unbelievable. There's one particular Facebook page that has over 125,000 people that have signed up to it. that's pretty unbelievable, and I think it shows the wide reach that his death has attracted.
Well, the quality media like yourself, other news organizations that are reporting the story have glommed onto it and are taking it to where it should go. But unfortunately, some of the tabloid media have grabbed onto this too and have focused more on the cannibalism aspect of the story rather than why it happened. And I'm not sure if we'll ever find that out. As a reporter, and I know your cell phone battery's dying, Mike, so I won't keep you too much longer. How do you, when you're in Edmonton and you're trying to investigate this further and speak with family members and try and put the pieces together, how do you not sensationalize this when it is a sensational story?
Well, what we've tried to, first of all, we've put warnings on all our stories that tell people, you know, this is going to be particularly graphic to read. Secondly, you write it responsibly. You don't savor in the terrible details. We've actually tried to downplay some of those details, including them later on in the story, so that by the time maybe people get to that, they've had suitable warning and that sort of thing, and not just sort of thrust it in their face. You got to be careful with your headlines, the overall way the story's presented. But you're right, it is a difficult balance because the facts are sensational, and so when you have facts that are sensational, it's tough to not come across as being sensational.
Yep.
And it's stories like this, albeit very rare, that wade into that sort of National Enquirer or World Weekly News territory, because we don't expect to hear about this in our own country.
Yeah, exactly. Another thing that we have to think about is copycat types of crimes. Thank God there haven't been any. And again, all the loons that are out there that will try and profit from this sad story. Your show's on Sunday on the Chorus and Ralco Radio Networks called Crime and Punishment. What's up this Sunday, Mike?
Well, we'll definitely be talking more about this and my visit here out to Edmonton and what I'm able to uncover over the next few days. We do our regular monthly feature, The Lost Children, looking at a high-profile missing persons case. We have a very interesting case coming up this Sunday and all that and much, much more.
There's always lots to talk about. Mike McIntyre, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Take care.
We'll talk soon. Bye-bye. That's Winnipeg Free Press crime reporter and syndicated radio host Mike McIntyre. And yeah, this story is just, it's as bizarre and as tragic as you can get. About 3 hours from where I live, I've traveled that road many, many times, and about 3 hours where Mike is from in Winnipeg. And if anyone can cover the story properly and professionally, Mike McIntyre can. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a few minutes with Pat Brown, criminal profiler, and we're going to continue on talking about the tragedy on the Greyhound bus. We're going to talk about the anthrax probe. Did the government get the right guy? We're going to talk about the Rockefeller case, Casey Anthony, you name it. We're going to do it. That's here on Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to continue on a little bit here with the tragic, brutal murder on a Greyhound bus in Manitoba, Canada, actually about 3 hours from where I am. We brought on Pat Brown. She's a criminal profiler, a frequent guest on this program. You see her on Nancy Grace and other shows. Hi, Pat.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Just interviewed a reporter who's actually in Edmonton, Alberta, doing some background on the alleged accused Vincent Lee. And this whole situation on this Greyhound bus is something, you know, in my 26 years of law enforcement and 12 years of doing this type of program, you know, you see the stuff in wicked horror movies. You don't see it in, you know, small town Canada highways in a Greyhound bus with passengers on it. I know you've been covering this story quite a bit on Canadian television. Your thoughts on the Greyhound massacre?
Well, I think that, you know, we're always shocked with something. It's just horrific and disgusting. And yet, if we actually look around the world, we'll find that these incidents do occur more frequently than we'd like to believe. But luckily, we don't hear about all of them.
Yeah.
And we forget about the other horrible one that happened 5 years ago or 3 years ago, a state over. This was a very fairly unusual one, and that we haven't seen that particular one at the moment up until this time. But we've seen other horrible, brutal, terrible murders. As a matter of fact, there was one, I think, I forget out where it is over in Europe, where the fellow had married his girlfriend, and he cut her head off, and he went running around swinging it at people, too.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he got the idea from the Greyhound thing, but he was also doing bizarre things with heads. So it's not like he's the only one who's ever done this, but certainly it was as gruesome as you can get. One of the big questions, of course, is going to be at this point that everybody's going to argue about, well, at least I'm going to argue about it. As most everybody says, the guy is psychotic,
yep,
and therefore he's a nutter, and he just went off, and so they kind of feel sorry for Lee now because he's obviously crazy, and that always concerns me when the people go down that path, because the sympathy seems to run away from the victim and the victim's family to a brutal killer, and I always have rather object to that, because not everybody who has some shades of schizophrenia or mental illness goes out and brutalizes people. That's usually a psychopath lying underneath all of it.
Absolutely, and I think you said that very well. The focus is on Vincent Lee, yet we're hearing very little about Tim McLean. There are quite a few tribute sites on the internet, and there's been some reporting in the Winnipeg Free Press reporter that I just spoke to prior to talking with you is trying to cover the story the best that he can. But in today's or yesterday's court appearance, Pat, I'm not sure if you heard this or not, the reporter was telling me that Lee, of course, would not respond to comments from the judge except violently shaking his head up and down or sideways and repeating, would someone please kill me or please kill me, things like that. Is this a is this a sign of, like you say, someone as a psychopath or someone who is playing the mental card thinking that he's going to get away with this?
Well, you know, it's hard to actually know, and that's the problem. And we'd like to have a clear-cut answer that we could look at this guy and say, oh, absolutely, he's just nuts and he's freaking out. On the other hand, we don't know that. The fact that he says he wants to be killed, it could be a number of reasons. One is he could be theoretically ashamed of what he did. He could know he's going to jail for the rest of his life. He doesn't want to go there. It could be just something to say to make himself look crazy. It's actually, if you look at psychopaths and the way they behave, or even how we all behave, it's amazing what we say sometimes.
Yep.
We don't plan these things out necessarily. Things come out of our mouths, and we express ourselves, and then if somebody's going to sit there and try to figure out all the meaning of it, well, everybody's going to come up with a slightly different meaning as to why he did that. But the fact remains, he picked out this guy as a victim. He thought about it. He planned it. He committed the crime, and there's where I end. I think it should end. I mean, that's it. You know, over for me. The sense of spending the fortunes that we're going to spend, of course, he's in Canada, and he can say, oh, just kill me, when he knows darn well that I'm a death penalty.
Yeah, exactly.
how easy is that to get away with the thing?
Yeah.
So, there's no death penalty. He can say that. And they're going to spend a fortune on his trial. And then they're going to send him off to the mental institution where he's going to have a life. He's going to make his pot holders and go to group therapy. He's going to tell a sad story. People are going to pat him on the back. And
yep,
the social workers are going to be kind to him. And he'll get visitors. And he'll have a pretty decent time. And if he gets through that at some point and he seems to be normal again, they'll let him back out again. So there's zero punishment
if
he goes that route. Meanwhile, all the money that was spent on him should have been spent on therapy for the family and for all the people on the bus, but they're never going to see a penny.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Switching gears here a little bit, I think the federal government happened to listen to the show that you and I did a while back about the anthrax case. No, I'm just kidding. But all of a sudden now, the feds came out and said that they had their man, is Bruce Ivins. Of course, we've seen the news coverage about it, about this particular individual who's since taken his own life. And a lot of people are coming out now, and including myself, and I think this is what you're going to say, saying, well, we're not sure if he was the guy or not. Let's get back to the anthrax.
Right. I think the biggest problem with this whole case at this point is that we don't believe them. I mean, I think that's what it comes right down to. We just do not necessarily believe the government. The fact is that they have, so many years later, they're suddenly coming out and saying they had all this tremendous evidence, even early on, that this guy sent these peculiar emails, and they all matched what they think matches the letters, and he's already saying he's psychotic and he's going crazy, and all this evidence pointed to him back in 2001. And they spent all the time chasing Hatfield around, and now that he's dead, oh yeah, we had all this evidence in 2001, and we think he's the guy that did it. It's kind of hard to buy.
Now, when you look at the story and it talks about fixation, like in the media, he has a fixation on this sorority. His former
that's the silliest one I've heard.
That
makes me laugh. Where it comes down to sometimes when they're trying to make their case is if you go back in time with anybody and you look for a connection to an area. What's Pat Brown's connection to the mailbox in Princeton? They work hard enough, they'll find one.
Right.
I play Scrabble. They'll find a Scrabble club in Princeton and say, she must have been up there at the Scrabble club, because they had a tournament right around the time of those anthrax mailings. And they're not going to be able to prove I went to the tournament, but since I played the Scrabble tournament, that must be the connection. So, these things are meaningless if you're going to sit there and try to go back in a person's life and dissect every bit of it and look for these connections. The use of looking for the connections should be early on, that when you've got a possible suspect and he's got a lot of coincidences and connections to different things, he's saying, this is very interesting. Proves nothing. It just means that we have some probable cause to move forward with an investigation and look further into this guy until we can come up with some true and solid evidence, not conjecture or just odd coincidences that we could paint on the guy. And I think that's the problem here. Now they're coming up with these little pieces of, oh, how about this and how about that? But it's like, so what?
When you see terms like classic offender behavior, even I, as I'm not a profiler, but I've been in the business long enough to know that's pretty basic. And when you have the so-called experts saying that this must have been the guy because he exhibited classic offender behavior, I'm actually reading from a news story right now, that must make you sit back, someone who's covered this case and investigated as long as you have, make you shake your head.
Well, it's easy to go back in retrospect and say, wow, we can see things here. And we're just manipulating ourselves into believing that's true. Again, if we saw this in the beginning, he certainly would be a person to look at. I would not have an objection if this information was around in 2001, taking a look at this man as possible suspect. Nor did I have a problem with Hatfield as a possible suspect.
Right.
Or the fellow that sent me the anonymous letters in the mail after I did the Fox interview and I profiled the anthrax killer. He sent me the materials, and he turned out to be a biology PhD at Rutgers, and the FBI would not investigate him. I would have definitely thought they should investigate him as well. And then you build on all the things you're investigating. You look for those clues and those pieces of evidence that are actually going to link. But you don't just run off with one and try to fit the crime onto him and then start sort of seeing that, he's got that offender behavior, because you want to see that. So I don't see that there's anything classic here at all. I think that they're just making that up at this point.
When we did our last interview, some of the comments that came back and things that I didn't get to cover with you very much was the term preoccupation with the media. Who doesn't have a preoccupation with the media? But it's a little different in an aspect like this. You get the stalkers that start sending letters to show hosts and things like that, and someone who's just absolutely glaring at the TV, thinking the way they are. What do you mean when you say preoccupation with the media?
Oh, right. Well, I when I profiled this particular person, I believed that because of the locations that the letters were sent to, like, for example, American Media, which is, our group that puts out the tabloid Star and Inquirer, that's a big media outlet.
Right.
When you said letters to the editor, New York Post, I believe, was one of them, one, too. Usually when you have them going to media outlets, you have someone who spends a great deal of time watching media, reading papers, and most likely if they want to get their opinions out there, they're writing tons of letters to the editor because they want to express themselves, they want to be recognized for their opinions. And I believe because of the way these mailings went out, this person would have that. Now, how much of it is the question. Now, we do see that Ivins had sent some letters to the local media in Maryland. And I read those letters, and I thought they were extraordinarily reasonable. I mean, I really liked the way the man expressed himself. I thought he was very fair, and they weren't outrageous or weird. The letters that were sent to me after the Fox interview by the suspect that I had, turns out that he sent out hundreds and hundreds of letters.
Mm-hmm.
ranting about ranting about crimes and Osama bin Laden and the government. I mean, his stuff was pretty weird. He'd say things like, "Well, I sent out 60 of the same copy of this letter to everybody, and so far nobody's responded." So he really was obsessed with the media, and that's the kind of person I believe. You know, there will be that obsession because of the outlets that the letters are sent to. But Ivan's had some interest in the media, that makes it seem how much.
You know, and if you're just tuning in, Pat Brown, criminal profiler, is here. You know, when we talked about rush to judgment, Pat, we can use that in this case, and there's a couple other cases that we want to talk about tonight, too. Sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes that's a bad thing. You want to throw out that wide dragnet, so to speak, and look at all aspects and not just be very narrowcast as far as who you're looking at. But when does that fit in, either from the perspective of a profiler or an investigator? You know, I think they blew it with the anthrax case, but then you look at someone like this Rockefeller, or whatever his name is, Mr. X, I guess. Here's someone, this is pretty clear-cut what's going on. It's funny they can't, with the database as big as it is, do something with his fingerprints, or maybe we're just not hearing about it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a very odd case how this man simply sort of appeared out of nowhere and apparently hoodwinked a whole pile of people. And I actually, at this point, I'm really surprised to hoodwink people, because when I was asked, where do I think he went to? This was when they were suspecting him running around the Caribbean, on his yacht. And I said, no, the guy's not on a yacht. I said, what I believe is happening is he's gone to New York, he said he's going east, over to get his yacht and go sailing, and the smarter thing, since he's got $300,000 worth of gold coins with him, is to go west, try to get across the border at some point, go down to South America, and live a happy, free life with all his money. And he'd do great that way. And then he ends up in Baltimore. And I'm like, what in the heck are you doing in Baltimore, for God's sake? And I couldn't believe it. I'm like, you're dumb. I mean, here I'm giving you some credit for, I'm thinking it's because you hoodwinked all these people, you must be a real smart cookie. But instead you go to Baltimore?
Yeah,
where
exactly.
You've been seen with your daughter, and you've got a catamaran there, which has been there forever, so the police tracked you right to your catamaran, which is sitting in Baltimore, and then they said it's taking on water, so you leave your daughter and go run and look at your catamaran? Okay. You're out here really not very bright. Yeah, I don't know who you fooled, but I mean, I was really stunned by that. I was like, oh my God. I'm glad he was dumb, but
Is that a typical narcissistic personality? Thinks that they can get away with anything and then they get caught real easy?
Well, yeah, he definitely has a narcissistic personality. He's psychopathic, but, I just thought because he'd been able to play this game for so long that he must be real slick. And of course, you can be arrogant and get caught, but I thought his plan would be a little bit better than in Baltimore. And maybe he thought nobody would look in Baltimore because who wants to go there? Hey, Baltimoreans are going to write me nasty letters now, but, hey, it's Baltimore.
Well, I agree with you. It's something, and it will be interesting to see in time what comes about as far as who this guy really is. Another case that we've been covering here on the program and every media outlet has been covering, and I'm sure you've talked about it too, is the poor little girl, Kaylee Anthony, Casey Anthony, the mom, is still in jail. I think they've officially filed charges against her now for child neglect and lying to the police. However, the question is wide open. Where is this child? Is she alive? Is she dead? Grandma joined us on the program last week. We may be able to get her again tonight. We'll see what happens. But this is a case, again, a seasoned investigator, seasoned profiler can sit down and, when you do the investigation, 1, 2, 3, it's easy to put the pieces together, or am I wrong?
Well, not in this case. I think this is where your rush to judgment isn't too much of a rush.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some cases where, quite frankly, like the anthrax case, you could have quite a few suspects. And there could be a lot of quirky fellows, especially, scientists and all that. There could be quirky dudes out there, and they say weird things, and you wonder who it could be. And you don't have all your facts on each one of them that really blink up really quickly, and it's very confusing. So it's a lot of work to dig through those things and try to figure out which one of these characters could it be. But in a case like this, first of all, we know who had the child, and that was Casey.
Yep.
And we know who did not have the child, and that was Casey.
Yep.
And we know who didn't report not having the child, and that was Casey. And we know who returned the the car with the dead body smell, and that was Casey. I mean, who's out partying and doesn't care about a kid, and that was Casey. Okay, I'm not having a real hard time with this one. You know, and there is no other suspect.
Yeah.
It's her.
No, and that's so true, and it just, you know, the truth eventually does come out, but when the truth comes out, you hear different versions, you hear different opinions, and what really is the truth. Our friend Drew Peterson, who I had on the show last week, too, doesn't think that the so-called wired tapes of him talking to the undercover informants is going to mean too much of anything, but I have to shake my head when all of a sudden undercover informants working for a state police agency are all over the media talking about what I believe they shouldn't be talking about. Let the courts decide. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't know. It depends what they're trying to achieve. I mean, sometimes information is purposely put out to take up suspects and to get other people to talk, or
yep,
to get the suspect to talk, or to give, you know, they have sometimes their reasoning, and I hope that it's a good reasoning. Sometimes it's not a bright move, but that can be why. I know in the case of Casey, where they released all the tapes from inside the jail, question is, why did they do that? You know, why did they want that out there? And I think it was to put pressure on Casey, to let everybody know that she wasn't it wasn't what she was trying to make out to be, and
yep,
what her mother was trying to make her out to be, that this is the real Casey, this is what we're dealing with. So I think sometimes they have the reasoning, and whether it works out, you know, one of the things people, I think, misunderstand sometimes is, especially when people write books, like the FBI comes out and writes the book about how they solved the case, and we use this psychological technique, we went in a room, and I said this, and I said that, and then I put an object down, and the guy looked at me, fell apart, and I was so clever. So I'm like, yeah, you tried that four of the times, it didn't work. But you know, you can always, you know, the time it works, you go, see how clever we were? I mean, when you do any kind of investigation, or any kind of interrogation or interview, a lot of times you're using your expertise, you're
yep,
using your experience, and sometimes you're flying by the seat of your pants, and you're crossing your fingers. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. That's the way it goes. I mean, it isn't a science where you can walk in and say, you know, I know if I say A, B, and C, D is going to happen here. You're going to go in, you're going to do your best, and the more experienced you are, and you know, the more experience you've had with dealing with investigations and interrogations, and the more success you've had, of course, you might have a higher track, you know, better track record. But even if you have a good track record, sometimes it just doesn't work, and you go, oh well, it's just not, you know, you just, that's what investigation's all about.
Well,
it's working out to you.
Well, the Anthony case is a good one as far as, is it making more sense to keep Casey Anthony in jail or to let her out? You know, what will actually bring out the truth? You let her out and you know, follow the case however, but keeping her in jail, this is, I don't know, has it been 3 weeks now or whatever it is? It seems like they've
got... She deserves to be there, first of all.
Yeah.
I mean, she doesn't deserve to be out of jail. She deserves to be in jail. She deserves to be indicted for what she did.
Yep.
I think keeping her there is a much better idea, because they're going to put pressure on her. They're going to be able to hopefully, you know, get her to talk at some point, because she'll think there's some point in doing so. But if you let her out, I think she's going to have a good time. And, you know, theoretically she could talk to somebody and say something, and you know, that information would come in. But hey, a lot of people get out on those circumstances, and years will go by, and nobody gets any information. So I think she's where she should be, and hopefully they'll follow the physical trail of evidence and eventually find Kaylee.
Yeah, I know. I agree with you. I think that this case is, whether she talks or not, and I hope she does eventually, this case is going to be based on forensics and where that will go. It should be interesting. But, you know, just before I let you go, Pat, again, the public's fascination. You and I could do a show daily, 3 hours a day, because these cases never seem to stop. Whether it's a beheading in a bus in Manitoba, Canada, to the Anthony case, to Drew Peterson, to you name it. And is it just me, or are we hearing more and more and more about these cases? Because, you know, watching television 4 or 5 years ago, before the cable news started, like the Fox News and all that sort of stuff, we didn't really hear about this much stuff.
Right. I mean, clearly a 24-hour media does make a difference. I mean, there's no question about it. Because I know when I travel, I'm amazed at how few crimes there are because I'm having a good time and I'm not watching them. I'm not watching the news and I'm not seeing the papers.
Right.
And somebody will finally say something and go, "Really? Wow. No clue." But I do think also we probably are seeing, the world is getting more crowded, and the more people you have per square mile, the more incidents you're going to have per square mile. So you're going to see more of it. Just like, if you're in a small country town compared to a building in New York City. Yeah, you've got, how many much times population, you're going to have that many more people doing things like this, and you're going to hear about it because they're still close by, even though, so the number's going to go up. So I think we do hear more about it, and I think it's because of the media. I think we have, say, the population has increased, and I do think we have an increase in psychopathy, an increase in people solving their problems in these bizarre ways. So I think we don't want to ignore that. That's important. As much as we could say it's because of population and the media, we really, as a society, need to look and find out why we're spawning so many psychopaths and why they're running around our streets like they are. And part of the problem is that we know with what's going on in our society, the way children are coming up. And part of the problem is a criminal justice system that is not either catching them and putting them away or allowing them to roll back on the streets, as we've seen with so many pedophiles. And as I say, if it can't, Lee goes in prison, into the mental institution, I wouldn't be surprised. We'll see him out in 10 years, and he'll be attending church someplace, and people say, look, that guy's okay now, and, he's trying to make a new life. And then, someday, all of a sudden, he's on another bus,
Yeah, I know exactly.
And, we should not let him out. But I think that we have to really look hard at why we have so much of this.
Well, it's one thing to have a rehabilitative society, but it's another thing when the reoffenders keep reoffending, and there's some that just can't be rehabilitated. Pat Brown, thank you.
No, thanks a lot. I'm sorry.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's criminal profiler Pat Brown. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back here on the Dana Pretzer Show.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're back. I want to give you an update on the case of the missing little girl from Orlando, Florida, Kaylee Anthony, and remind you to go to the website that talks about her disappearance, www.helpfindkaylee.com. That's www.helpfindkaylee.com. And on the line with me is Kaylee's grandma, Cindy. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, good evening, Dana.
You must be exhausted with media requests and media interviews and all that, so I certainly won't keep you very long. But I thought I would call and get an update. I have three or four questions here that my audience and I would like to ask. First of all, how are you and George coping?
I don't even know. I mean, we both went all day and didn't even eat until about 9 o'clock this evening, so we didn't even realize we hadn't eaten. That's the type of day that we've had, and that's a typical type of day that we've had. So you never know what's going to come in play. You plan something, and then it changes, as the day goes on. So we just learn to go with the flow.
Absolutely. The media have been all over this story continual. I know you did a rather lengthy interview with Greta Van Susteren, and other networks have been covering this. But some of the news that came forward today was that there was a visit to your home from crime scene investigators once again. Can you comment on that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have no problem with that. We've been working very closely with them from day one looking for any thing that could help us find Kaylee. And, we've told them from day one our home's an open door for them. So if there's anything that they want to look at or anything they want to check out, they're free to come and go. And essentially, they needed to come and check out a few things today, so we allowed them to come in the house and, let them do their thing.
Have you spoken to your daughter today?
No, I have not spoken with her for, it'll be a week tomorrow.
Okay.
So.
Now, one thing that, Cindy, that absolutely puzzles me when it comes to this investigation, and please correct me if I'm wrong, and I don't mean to be intrusive, but I believe, from listening to interviews, listening to you, talking to your husband, that you and your husband believe that Kaylee is alive, and she's being held somewhere. Am I correct?
Well, I mean, that's what our gut feeling is. That's what we believe. It's hard to say day by day, if those things are going to, if our feelings are going to change, but our gut feeling in our heart, we know she's still out there, and we get a lot of people that feel the same way. I mean, call it intuition, call it, whatever. I'm connected to her, and just like the intuition that I knew something was wrong the day that I, Casey and I finally connected and Kayla wasn't there, that made me pick up the phone and, call for assistance. It's the same feeling that I have, that Kaylee's okay. I just need to, I guess I need to learn patience, but I wanted her, a few weeks ago. I want her now. I want her especially before Saturday.
Right.
As you know, it's her birthday. So
right.
I'm getting more and more impatient every day. It's just harder and harder every day to wake up and not have her here and not see her and hear her little voice and give her a hug and just all the normal things that, you do with her.
Investigators, I'm sure, have shared things with you that you can't disclose, but something that you have disclosed is that, and you have concerns about, are some of the mistruths that have come forward, some of the lies. The media really focused on the gas cans and the shovel and things like that. But if we were to stick with the hypothesis that and hopefully it's true, that Kaylee is alive and she's being held somewhere, do you think that that's somewhere in the area where you live, or that Casey would know where that would be?
Well, Casey's maintained from day one that she doesn't know where Kaylee is. She knows who has Kaylee, or at least who started out having Kaylee. I'm sure at this point, whoever took Kaylee has to have some assistance, because it's very hard, I would think, to keep a child hidden, by yourself for any length of time like this has come through. And I would think that, and this person would have had assistance, the person that Casey has said that has Kaylee. But she's maintained from day one that she doesn't know where Kaylee's at, and she is fearful for her safety. And that's part of, part of the issues that Casey's had from the beginning. She tried very hard to locate this person and hang with people that could help her figure out where this person is so that she could retrieve Kaylee without incident, and certainly without harm. I can't go into particulars, but things that we've talked about with the authorities, because, we just don't want to jeopardize Kaylee's safety in any way.
Is there a concentrated search? That's another puzzle that, I'd like to ask about. I know in my program here, Cindy, that I've worked very closely with an organization called Texas Equisearch, who specialize in going and searching for the missing. Is there actually an organized search that's going on, and have you or your family considered contacting an organization like Texas Equisearch to help it look?
Well, this is the first I've heard of that organization. Again, we're novices at all this. We really don't know what's available out there to us unless someone, has brought that to our attention, and we'll reach out to them. So certainly, if there's an organization out there available that would help us with an organized search, I'll reach out in a heartbeat. And so when we're off the air, if you could give me that information, certainly tomorrow I'll reach out to them. Now, as far as a an organized neighborhood search or anything like that, I'm not sure if that's going to happen, or if it is, when it's going to happen. That, again, will have to come down to the authorities. Now, what Georgia and I and Lee have been trying to organize is through volunteers, with flyers and things like that, and the calls that we make when we go out, if we have a tip in a certain area, there's an ability for us to use our network to make calls in that area just to kind of let them know that there is a child alert. So, with that, that's kind of as organized as we can get. We have people in certainly all over the Orlando area and surrounding Central Florida area, but we've got people, like in Miami and Sarasota and different places throughout the United States that we've either had tips or we've had leads or even suggestions from Casey. I mean, right on the beginning, she did give the authorities several different locations for them to check into, and I know they have been. It's just a long process.
You know, Cindy, and this is my last question, and I really appreciate your time because I know how exhausted you are. We as parents and we as grandparents, we do what we can to protect and shelter our children, and we want to believe everything that we can to make sure that all will be right, that your granddaughter will be home for her birthday, that she's alive. I hate to be blunt like that.
Right.
But you know, deep down, absolutely as deep down as you can, and I admire the faith that you and your husband are showing, and the commitment to get answers. But deep down at night, do you, like you say, you're getting impatient. When will the time be that you say enough is enough?
Well, you know, naturally, if there's anything concrete that proves otherwise. Right now, again, unless I wake up and get a sick feeling that she's no longer with me,
right,
you know, then, you know, I still believe, and I have every reason to believe, because I know Casey has been a wonderful mother, and, you know, that there's, and she had, you know, if she wanted to step back, she had a reason. So it's not like, you know, she got tired of being a mom or anything like that, or she was a single mom by herself and had nowhere to turn if she needed to step back and become a 22-year-old again.
Right.
So that's not the case. I mean, Casey, I think she's demonstrated mother qualities that, oh my gosh, you know, the ones that I know that I had that my mom showed me and her mom showed her. But, I mean, she's exhibited even things far beyond what I could even teach her. So, I mean, I am very confident, and everybody that knows Casey, knows her with Kaylee, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that she's had no hand in any premeditated or any demise of Kaylee. So, you know, the only thing that I worry about is the person or persons that may have Kaylee may be worried at this point because, you know, they didn't realize that this was going to be on the national level that it was when it first started out in June, that may get scared. And that's the thing that frightens me day by day, you know, minute by minute, second by second, that someone may feel that, you know, if we are getting closer to them and locating them, they may end up just trying to do something and get rid of Kaylee. And that is my biggest fear. Not that Casey had a hand in it, but that someone's going to have a change in heart. And I just hope if someone's out there listening that has Kaylee, you know, I will be the first one to go for, you know, put that, if you have a change of heart, and bring her in, or if you can be anonymous and, you know, just give her to the authorities in some way, fire station, hospital, or whatever.
Right.
Just like they tell, you know, moms that don't feel like they could be a mom, to abandon their child only into a safe situation. You know, don't leave her on a street corner all by herself in the middle of the night, but put her, place her somewhere where an adult can see her and, you know, and contact the authorities. And, you know, I will forgive if you can bring her back safely to us.
Cindy, give my best to George. And what I will do is, if you check your email later tonight,
sure,
or tomorrow, I'll send you some information. And we'll,
great,
we'll,
I would appreciate that.
We'll stay in touch. Cindy, Anthony,
right,
thank you.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, one thing that we can say for sure is that we're going to get some answers in this case. And if there's an organization that can help search and recover, I'm going to use that term, we'll see what we can do to try and help with that. I've got about 4 or 5 minutes left here in the program. If you'd like to call in, 306-842-7884, 306-842-7884. And, you know, is there an easy answer in any of this? No, there's not. Do the investigators sit back and think about this nonstop? A good investigator will. A good investigator will be covering all the bases. And I hope that they're out doing some searches right now in the area, in different places, potential places where Kaylee might be found. And we can only hope that Kaylee will be found alive. And the story will come to fruition, and we'll learn everything that's actually happened here. Because if there's ever been a story in the media that has gone 360 degrees, 360 different ways, it's this one. Again, keep the phone line open for just a minute or two, just to finish up the show. If you have any comments on any of the cases that we've talked about tonight, 306-842-7884. 306-842-7884. You can call in and talk about anything you like. And I think there's a caller on the line right now. Hi, you're on the air.
Dana, it's Red.
Hey,
time.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
You know, I've been battling the flu the last couple of days, and it's one of those, you know, you just ache from the tip of your toes to the tip of your nose kind of flus, and you can't seem to get rid of it, but, you know, I'll shake it eventually.
I guess there is a 90-degree heat there.
Yeah, it's that way, too. You know, it's hard in an old fat guy like me to stumble around out in that heat.
Okay.
You know, I want to get your thoughts on the Greyhound bus thing, which is actually about 2.5 hours away from where I am. I've traveled that road many, many, many times. And you know, we can think of Daniel Pearl, the graphicness of that, and a lot of other cases, like Pat Brown was saying, but this is, you know, this is small town Canada. This stuff doesn't happen up here, but I guess it does. It's just an absolutely wild, bizarre story.
Yeah, I actually made the mistake of watching the Danny Pearl video online one time.
Yeah, I did once too, yeah.
And regretted that ever since.
Yeah.
You know, It obviously shows us it can happen anywhere. The more unnerving part, which even Mike brought up, because I had read about the Greyhound ad campaign that they're doing, which you're like, oops. You just don't know who you're sitting next to these days. Can you imagine being on a bus?
No.
And such close, I mean, I don't care whether it's a bus, a train, a plane, you name it, and you have that sitting next to you, which was obviously a ticking time bomb, and just unfortunately went off when it did. I know from just looking at the volumes of people who have been on. I mean, we've had, I don't think there's a town in Canada that hasn't been on Scared Monkeys reading this story.
Right.
The amount of people that have, you know, come over to take a look and you know, read some of the comments and stuff. And it's something that, you know, it is like your worst fear come true. You know, I heard you make the comments about, you know, obviously anybody on the net is, you're going to have, you know, your sane people, you're going to have people that go off the deep end and make some pretty vicious comments about the people that were on the bus themselves, what they should have or could have done. I mean, I will say this, Dana, and I don't think it's because Canadians are not cowards. They're not,
nope.
You know, all this other nonsense that people have put forth. I think there's a difference just in the fact that 9/11 did not happen to Canada,
right,
per se. And I think it makes a big difference in how people don't want to be victims. We covered a shooting at a church in Tennessee not less than, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, where a guy opened fire with a shotgun, and he was loaded for bear.
Yep.
And he could have made that church look worse, made Virginia Tech look like look pale in comparison.
Right.
But if it was not for the fact that people immediately went at this guy who had a loaded shotgun and tackled him and took him to the ground, the carnage would have been just horrific, and all of the media would have been in Knoxville, Tennessee,
yep,
as opposed to, you know, the next place where they decided to go. So I think when we see stuff like that, when we see the shoe bomber, when people did that thing on the plane, I think it's more of a knee-jerk reaction from 9/11, more so than anything, which affected this country, Canada suffered it with us. It didn't really happen to them,
right.
And it does take some gumption to go after somebody to try to help somebody that you don't know. And I more to the point would agree with you. I would tend to say I have a little bit of an issue with what the police did.
Mm-hmm.
You're a cop, Dana. You would have had my permission to have stormed the thing, have taken him out with a sniper rifle, anything. We knew the poor guy was dead, and his family didn't need everything else that happened afterwards. When police waited 2 hours to try to talk this man down off the ledge, I mean, he did what he did. We know what he did. You know, take him out at that point and save the poor guy from his family the pain and the suffering and the anguish.
Oh, I agree. I agree. And sadly, this story is far from being over. And the family will have to suffer more and more and more as the days go on. But I want to talk a little bit about the Anthony case with you. This is one that's I don't have a lot of hair left on my head. But when I'm done scratching it after watching some of the media coverage, and I've spoken to Grandma and Dad George on the air, and I have my own personal thoughts about what happened to this little girl, but I also have to wonder just the focus of the investigation. And I mentioned Texas EquiSearch tonight. Is there a park nearby? Is there a riverbed nearby? Is there a field nearby? Has it been searched? Is there different things? We all hope and pray that this little girl is alive. But, you know, you also have to look and do what's called a recovery operation, too. Is that happening? And it doesn't sound like it has been. But this case, I know Greta has spent 2 hours with the family and did a very nice interview with them, but then the next comment that she gets from her panel says that they're all liars, psychopaths, and will all go to jail for killing the little girl. There are different ways of handling stories, and this story is a tragic one, and the only victim that I see right now is the little girl, Kaylee.
Yeah, I mean, it's tragic all the way around, Dana. The only victim usually is the missing person, or sadly enough, if it's an expired child. I think the biggest problem probably that police are having with even trying to do any form of a search is, you're a police officer yourself, Dana.
Yep.
You don't generally do searches. You guys do investigations.
Yep.
You guys do, you're after the criminal side of it. And when they took, over a month to report this child missing, that automatically kind of throws a lot of the search that you would normally do initially right out the window, because, it's not like all of a sudden, a day later, 2 days later, a child goes missing and you have a general vicinity of where they, and then you could set up, we're going to search a grid from what area to what area. This thing went on for a month, well over a month. So where do you start?
Yep.
And if you can't get any answers from the mother, I mean, and we don't know what they're saying to police,
uh-huh.
But obviously they're not giving, no one is giving up a location. And the police obviously keep going back to the residence for more and more evidence to see if they can't find something. I mean, maybe somebody has said something and they're trying to corroborate evidence. Who knows? But it just is not going to be your normal search of, let's go out into a field because this was the general location she went missing in,
right,
or this was the last place that she was seen. I mean, when damn near 5 weeks goes by, there are some, there is some, and I realize the family has been highly critical on the media, because and in some cases, yeah, they may have a point. It doesn't serve any purpose to be shock radio, shock TV, get your little cutesy comments out. It sounds really neat, but it doesn't serve any purpose. But in this particular case, I mean, the family kind of does have to answer to the fact of, 5 weeks went by and why,
sure,
why didn't they report it?
Yep.
It is something where, there really hasn't been a real answer to that question, and that's the obvious question. You know, who in their right mind doesn't report something like that? And generally, the only answer is if you're being threatened by someone who took a person.
Right.
And, you know, if that's not the case, I mean, and if you're not willing to say that to the police, well, you know, of course all eyes and fingers are going to be pointed at you.
Yeah, no doubt. I look at interview style in the media. There's probative questions, and then there's demanding questions, and then there's the pound your fist on the table type of questions. And I'm not sure what kind of questions need to be asked in this case to get answers, but I don't know. It's a tough one, and we'll keep following up on it for sure. Anyway, thank you, Red.
Thank you, Dana. You take it easy, and I will talk to you soon.
Take care, sir. Yeah, bye-bye. All right, that's another show. We call it the Dana Pretzer Show. My webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com, and there you can listen to the show live, listen to podcasts of past shows and daily commentaries, and leave comments. If you need to email me, my email address is dana@scaredmonkeys.com. Thank you to all my guests, and we'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.